Well, as I said before we got going here, one of my big joys is to look at church history. It's one of the things that actually drew me into the Orthodox faith was studying not so much the history of the American church, but really the history of the early church. But what's striking to me is how seamlessly every epoch of history in the church, it goes from one epoch to the next, to the next, to the next. It's beautiful and seamless. But we want to define, in beginning here, we want to define some terms that we'll be talking about tonight. The first one is the Russian mission. Our theme tonight is the Orthodox experience in America, and particularly my talk, as opposed to the other priests later on, will be the Russian and OCA experience in North America. So a lot of things will have to do with Russian terms. The Russian mission to Alaska is the initial evangelization push thrust into Alaska beginning at the very end of the 1700s. Then we can speak of the Russian-American missionary diocese, or the mission diocese, which was a broadening out of this initial effort from Alaska down to the lower 48, beginning in the middle of the 1800s, the 19th century. And then we can speak also of a Russian metropolia, which, that's a short form of Russian Orthodox Greek Catholic Church in North America. That's a total of 8 words. That's what our church was known as from the year 1920 or so until 1970. So for about 50 years, the church that we identify with here, we're an OCA parish, what was called the Russian Orthodox Greek Catholic Church in North America, or the Metropolia. And in 1970, that became the Orthodox Church in America. And we'll talk about how well this happened. But that's the kind of the defining terms here. We're going to hear tonight about a lot of competing and interrelated forces. And these forces will be shown to have molded our particular church, the OCA, but also to have molded the other churches in America. And I want to name 5 of these forces. Maybe we can name more later. But I think there's 5 that I can see clearly. Number one is a missionary vision. A missionary vision was really part, one of the main forces that helped mold our church. A second one is immigration patterns and policies. Immigration and the policies about immigration on the part of the United States. Number 3, world historical events, that is, depressions, wars, financial expansions, contractions, all of those things. Number 4, nationalism and the passions of nationalism. Number 5, and this might be more so in some of the Greek parishes, but somewhat in the metropolia in the 20s, party politics, particularly socialists versus radical monarchists, or monarchists versus radical socialists, which actually was a big deal in a number of places in the Orthodox communities in America. So we'll touch on that later on. So anyway, these are our terms, and these are the kind of forces we've identified. Let's start by just beginning where things began in 1794. At baptism in our church, does anyone know the reading that we take, the gospel reading we take at baptisms, other than Bert? What do we read? It's the Gospel of Matthew. It's the last pericope, the last passage. It is, "Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, for lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. Amen." And this is the foundational thing the church is given by God to do. To go into the world, to make disciples, to baptize, to teach them, and to make present Him who is present everywhere and filling all things. This is the task of the Christian church. And then note, by the way, it's not you, Chris, go into all nations. It is go. This is King James. Go ye into all nations. It is plural. That's why Dr. Luke Ward would say King James is the way to go. If you ever want a conversation with him on that, go. He will have fun with you on that. But going into all the world, into every nation, is part of the DNA of our church. And it's inherently communal. It's never individualistic. And I think as we can see, looking at the lives of the apostles, 11 out of 12 of them were martyred. And John himself was almost martyred twice. Should have been martyred. Given that statistic, we can say that missionary work is an incredibly ascetical and self-denying exercise. It's a very hard thing to do. And I think, frankly, I think the modern kind of Protestant model of, you know, let's raise some money and go out to the field for a year or two and have kind of, you know, I'm not sure that really is that relevant to the mission work that we read about in the gospel and that we see in the first four centuries of the Christian faith. It's a very different model. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just very different. But very common in Christian history was the fact that missionaries were wholly consecrated to Christ, both spiritually and physically. And we first see this with whom? He's the first missionary we see wholly consecrated to Christ, not having a family, really focused. St. Paul. He says in 1 Corinthians 7, he says, I wish that all could be as I am. He's speaking about with regard to being married. Because he can give himself totally, 100% to the spreading of the gospel. And in the early Christian church, most of the great evangelizations, most of the missionary undertakings took place with a highly focused team of monastics or celibate Christian missionaries. Because the idea was the missionaries live and die as natives. They live and die among the people. They're not separated. They're not always going home for R&R. They are living and dying and committed completely to the people that they serve. Some examples of this, and this is really, you know, not that you're taking notes, but if you were taking notes, this is a really neat list here. Just I spent about an hour just thinking through all these missionaries, and almost every great missionary movement I can think of in the church involves a cadre of monastic people, people radically committed to the gospel. St. Gregory the Illuminator, we commemorate him tonight in the church. He was married, he had these two kids, his wife died. Basically, he and his children started the monastic movement inside Armenia. And they, with the king and the support of the state, they evangelized the entire country. The nuns that were referred to tonight in the commemoration, Ripsimia and Guyana, they were nuns, and they were part of this missionary outpost into Armenia. St. Nina, a woman, it's really neat, you have a woman enlightener of Georgia, who was blessed, according to tradition, by the Theotokos to sovereignly do this, because the Theotokos, according to Georgians, drew Georgia as her lot. You know, it's a great story. But she had to send a woman to go in her place. So she sends Nina. And Nina is a virgin nun. And she goes to bear witness, and by her piety and holiness, she converts the king. It's beautiful. The great missionary to the Goths, who was actually an Arian, but was still a great missionary, was Ulfilas. And he was a monk as well, he was half Gothic, half Greek, sent out by the Arian bishop in Constantinople. The great Celtic missionary saints and the later Roman missionary saints of England and Ireland and Scotland, like St. Patrick, St. Columba, St. Augustine of Canterbury, these were all monks. They were living a very intense, focused life for the sake of the Lord. Saints Cyril and Methodius are probably the best known missionary saints in our tradition. They were monastic brothers who were committed to the mission work in the Slavic lands. They were from Thessalonica, and which is on the Aegean Sea, there, right on the edge of Greece, kind of heading towards Constantinople. And they lived there, and there was a Slavic tribe that had invaded, and they learned the local Slavic language, and they'd trade with them. And when they got older, they realized they had this gift, and the bishop commissioned them to go. And they created an alphabet, and a whole written scheme for transmitting the gospel to these people. And that was what they and their brotherhood did. That was their entire task. And what's funny is they failed. In their lifetime, they failed. When they died, everything seemed to be failure. But it's their disciples, their monastic disciples, who go back in defeat. And then several years later, the Bulgars convert, and then the Russians convert. But St. Cyril and Methodius never lived to see that. But their brotherhood persevered through all those ups and downs. St. Sava of Serbia, he was a wealthy prince, son of the Tsar of Serbia, who was a pagan, and he converts, and by his holiness and his witness and his self-denial, he converts his father, and his father ends up dying with him in the monastery, and they convert all of Serbia to the Orthodox faith. You have St. Stephen of Perm, an amazingly gifted man who single-handedly organized a small group of monks and converted an entire tribal people that comprised most of the Ural Mountains in the 14th century. You have two monks, Urg and Varsanufi, who, after the Tartars are conquered by the Russians, the Tartars used to, remember the Tartar yoke, they oppressed the Russians for a long time. After they were defeated, the Russian church sent these two converted Tartars, monks, into Tartarstan, ended up converting half the population to Christianity. And to this day, most of the Tartars are actually Christian, even though there's still a Muslim population. But many of them, if not most, are Christians. Saint Nikolai of Japan, 19th century, a monk. He goes as the chaplain for the embassy in Tokyo. There's not one Orthodox Christian in the country. When he dies, there's 20,000. It's incredible. He committed himself completely to these people, and he died with them. And it broke his heart when he was a very old man. There was the Russo-Japanese War, 1905, and he actually had to pray for the Japanese against his own people. And he retired after that because it just broke his heart. But he was not willing. He did not leave. When Japan went to war with Russia, he did not leave. He stayed with the people because he had committed himself to them completely. It's absolutely incredible. But this is how the Alaska Mission begins. This is how the American church begins. And this is a very powerful narrative. And it's, as I was going over this, I don't want to back down from this narrative at all because it's so incredibly rich and so wonderful. Let's kind of begin the narrative here with Alaska. You know, in 1620, it was Plymouth Rock was 1620, right? Around the same time, beginning in the 1640s, Russian settlers began to build establishments along the Bering Sea. They're on the coast of Russia, Russian Siberia. And they began to send people over to do trading and to engage in fur trapping by themselves and with the Indians there into Russian Alaska, which was claimed by Russia. And so from that date, the 1640s, trappers and adventurers explored Russia and sometimes would settle down, intermarry with the native women, and they'd actually baptize... I'm sorry? What did I say? Oh, yeah, the Russians would intermarry with the Alaskans, the Alaskan natives, the women. And so many of the... Yes, don't chuckle too loud there. They would intermarry, and they would actually baptize all their children, you know, but there was no church there. By the mid-1700s, many of the outlying islanders were completely mixed. You had Aleuts and Russians, and you could not tell which ones had Aleuts. Maybe they were a little lighter skin, but their culture was basically a hybrid culture. And in 1784, a Russian trader named Gregory Shelikov established a North American base in Alaska. With the blessing of St. Petersburg, the capital of the Russian Empire, he installs Alexander Baranov as the manager of this place. And Baranov would basically rule Alaska as a kind of petty dictator for 27 years and would do all kinds of things to make life difficult for not only the natives, but particularly the monastic missionaries who would come. But the imperial court, as was often the case in Christian countries, was sensitive to the idea of Christianizing the people that were part of the empire. What is the main point of you being Tsar? Well, it's to share the truth of the faith. This is what many of them actually believe this. Even Catherine the Great, who was the empress at the time, you know, she was not exactly a perfect Christian, by any stretch of the imagination. But this idea was so strong that even she felt, and what we can tell is she was really concerned about this. This was important to her, that we Christianize these people out in Alaska who were total pagans. So, she and the court commissioned and recruited monks from the island of Vallam. Can we have the first slide, Bert? From the island of Vallam. Vallam is an island in the middle of Lake Ladoga. The Arctic Circle runs right here, right through here. Right, St. Petersburg is just below it. Vallam is right here, roughly. And anyway, this is a very, very cold, cold place. And that's where St. Herman was formed. And that's where the imperial court drew the first round of missionaries to Alaska from this place. Would you just show us the next slide, Bert? There it is. There's part of the monastery. This is Vallam Monastery. Most of these buildings here were built in the 1800s, but some of them predate that. Next slide, please, Bert. These kind of buildings have been more common. This is actually an island called Kiji, but these kind of buildings would have been on all Vallam that St. Herman knew and that the Alaskan missionaries would have known. So they came from this kind of culture and were sent with great fanfare from Vlam via St. Petersburg with a huge goodbye committee and everything, because this is the first time that foreign missionaries were being sent. Russia had a great missionizing tradition, but it was always within inside the official borders of Russia. Alaska was like, it was considered a foreign dependency. It wasn't really, even though it was Russian territory, it was foreign. So this is the first foreign mission effort of the Russian church. So it was a big deal. And they sent them out, and as they sent them out through Russia across Siberia, they interacted with all the missionary monasteries, and they learned the ways of these missionary monasteries. And they were actually formed in what they were doing as they went across Russia towards Alaska. It was very, very interesting. So, in this party were several people. One archimandrite. An archimandrite is a high-ranking monastic priest. You know, it's kind of like it's one step below a bishop, but it's not a bishop. One archimandrite, three hieromonks, which is like me, but a monk, a monastic priest. One hierodeacon, which is a monastic deacon. And one lay monk, and two or three lay assistants. The party left St. Petersburg on December 1793, and they arrived September 24th, 1794. And this date, September 24th, 1794, is considered, at least by the OCA Metropolia culture, to be the beginning of Orthodox Christianity. The church presence, the beginning is that date. But the irony of all these people, you know, this was 1794. In 17, and in 1808, guess who'd be left? Not the archimandrite, not the hieromonks, not the hierodeacon. All that'd be left would be one lay monk, St. Herman. He wasn't a priest. He wasn't a deacon. He was the simplest kind of monk you could have. I don't even think he was a schema monk. I don't know. He was just a very common monk. And he was all that was left. But on the arrival in 1794, the monks were not struck by how primitive things were or how cold things were. Because remember, they're from Vlam. They were used to cold, and they had skeets around this monastery. This is a big island. You have skeets all around that are very primitive. And the main buildings were quite developed, but outside you could go do really rustic kind of things, like Spruce Island. But anyway, they were not upset by the climate or by how rough things were. They were immediately scandalized by the exploitation of the native people and the cruelty of the Russian settlers. Not so much the Russian businessmen, because the ones that settled down and married the local women, they were fine, because they loved them. It was the higher-up profiteering-type folks who really offended the monks and who combated the monks at every step of the way. And they immediately got in trouble with the manager named Baranov. But nonetheless, work began. The hieromonks Juvenali and Makari, within two or three years, had baptized thousands and tens of thousands of people, most likely. Makari baptized the Sukbiak people. And the question was, how? How did you go from visiting a place and baptizing? And all we can tell from the record is that what drew people to him as a proclaimer of the gospel was he interceded with the people before the Russian authorities. He would go to bat for them. He showed love for them. He was kind to them and to their children. And he explored, they would explore analogies between native mythology and the Christian story. They would look at what you've been proclaiming. Well, this is what we say, and this fulfills what you said. And this is a very important missiological point to make. Because we don't just go and obliterate the culture. If you look at St. Stephen of Perm, you look at St. Shlomo Methodius, they embrace the culture, and then they would seek to transform it. So with these methods, on Kodiak Island alone, which was the center of things, 7,000 people, natives, were baptized there. But immediately there were some challenges to the Russian mission. We spoke already of the Russians themselves being a big challenge. The second thing was the death of key leadership position people. The archimandrite, whose name was Joasoph, he was a very gifted man, very well connected. He left to go raise awareness about the abuse. He went back to Petersburg to fight for the natives. And while he was gone, the church, they liked him. They made him a bishop. They sent him back. His ship sank, and he and all the missionaries died. That was what happened. They had a whole bunch of them coming that were going to really augment the work of the mission, and they all died. And then shortly thereafter, Father Juvenali, because remember there was the two iron monks that went preaching, Father Juvenali and Father Macari. Father Juvenali was martyred. The story, we commemorated him recently. As the story goes, he was preaching to a group of people. He'd already baptized a whole tribe. He went to the other tribe that didn't like that first tribe. And they decided they wanted to kill him. And so they set upon him. They tried to kill him. They couldn't quite kill him. And finally, as the story goes, he crossed himself. The natives recorded that he kept throwing his arm across his chest. That's what it says, the natives, how they reported it. And then he finally died. And they, because he wouldn't die immediately, though, they actually hacked him to pieces. And his relics have been lost. But according to the natives, the story went, a light would appear there randomly over where he was martyred. The way he died and the whole circumstances around it was part of what helped that tribe eventually be baptized. It was that witness. You actually hear all the same stories with the Spanish in Florida. The Spanish are really good in Florida. I'm from Florida. I know the stories. And very similar kinds of things. It was the blood of the martyrs and these people that would lay down their lives freely without bitterness that would draw these people back to the church and to Christ. So that's the story of very short version of the story of St. Juvenali. So ultimately, only Monk Herman is left. And what does he do? Well, he moves from the big city out to a small island, Spruce Island, from Kodiak to Spruce Island. And there are two islands separated by a narrow channel of water. Ben Temby just spent a while there. So afterwards, he can tell you about it. I'm not going to say tons about Father Herman because Bert and I are going to do a lot more of this in December when we get to his feast. But basically, he lives a holy life. He prays the hours. He defends the natives. He takes orphans in. And when people want to be baptized, he baptizes them. And he teaches them about the gospel. And he reads the gospels. And he has a couple books. And he prays. That's all he does. And he died in 34, 37. And so he was there 30 some odd years. And that's all he did. And yet by the time he died, thousands of people had become not just baptized, but committed Orthodox Christians. And to this day, his memory has not faded there among the natives. They talk about Father Michael Alexa, who is like the expert on this. He writes this wonderful book, Orthodox Alaska. This is a great resource here. I think we have one in the library. This is a delightful read. It's called Orthodox Alaska, a Theology of Mission. And Father tells a story of how when he first went to Alaska, they would speak about Father Herman as if he's alive. Oh, Father Herman did this. He did that. He's so nice. He did. That's just part of their experience of St. Herman. Another of the early kind of heroes there was St. Peter the Aleut. And we know very, very little about him. We commemorated him this past week with St. Juvenali, the martyrs of Alaska. St. Peter was a young Aleut boy who had been baptized. And he had really identified with the Orthodox faith. He was kidnapped by some Franciscans in California, Spaniards, and they were anxious to bring the gospel to all the native peoples of the New World. So he was tortured, and his fingers were chopped off one by one, and he refused to deny Christ and refused to leave the faith that he had been baptized into. And he died after being tortured. He lost, I think, all his fingers and all his toes and his feet, and he died of blood loss. And St. Herman immediately, he was an old man at the time. St. Herman, when he heard of this story, he simply stood up and said, "Holy martyr Peter, pray to God for us." And that's all we know. And the people of Alaska just sort of remembered, oh, there's this martyr Peter. We don't know anything about him, but there's this little boy who's an Aleut, who's a martyr. And that's how we've kept his memory in the church. But we know nothing about him other than these bare details. Would you put up the next photo? This is an icon of St. Herman. And somewhere there was one painting of a true likeness of him, and all the icons have been based on the true likeness. I don't have it. But this one kind of reflected the painting I saw a long time ago. Kind of broad, kind of St. Seraphim Sarov looking. Very Russian looking. Next slide, please, Bert. Oh, no. No, that's okay. That's good. I don't have one of St. Innocent. I'm sorry. The next person to speak briefly about is St. Innocent. St. Innocent came to Alaska in 1824 while St. Hiram was still alive as a young priest. And his name at the time was John Veniaminoff. And he had a wife and children and a mother-in-law who arrived in Alaska together. He amazed the natives by learning Onongan Aleut. He eventually learned Tlingit and Eskim, various other languages. And into Aleut, he translated the Gospel of Matthew, important services, a catechism, and he wrote a couple of short books in the language that he himself had crafted for these people, an alphabet based upon Russian that was new to these people. He opened in 1828, being there 4 years. Imagine, I've been here 4 years. He opened a parish school 4 years after he arrived, having made up an alphabet for these people in his spare time. He's a better time manager than me. He was married. He was a married priest with children. The natives would marvel because he was known for his language skills, his respect for their customs, and his pastoral sensibility. He would always be present with them, always listen to them, and always respect their customs no matter what they were. In 1836, he becomes the first Orthodox priest to visit the lower 48. He went down to San Francisco to scope out some places for a parish. And while he was there, he hung out with the Franciscans. He had a better time than Peter the Aleut did. He actually made a clock for them while he was a clockmaker. He was a very gifted tinkerer type guy. He's a polymath. He's brilliant. And in 1839... as part of his regular, I think it was the first time he'd ever done it, but he was called to report to the Holy Synod in Petersburg. So he left to go for about 6 months, and while he was away, he got word that his wife had died. So they had a wonderful idea. We're going to make you a monk tomorrow and make you bishop the next day. And so he became, within a period of a month, was elevated to become bishop of Alaska, and was sent back to Alaska, where he continued his work, but as a monastic bishop. Eventually, because of his successes, he's so popular that the Russian church decided to need him to be head of a bigger diocese. So they move him to Irkutsk, which was also a missionary diocese, very similar to Alaska. It was almost as remote as Alaska. It was further. It was, you know, just across the Bering Strait, and he was given jurisdiction over both Alaska and Irkutsk. And he succeeded in doing some incredible work there. And because of his work, next slide, Bert. Because of his work, he becomes an advanced old age. They elect him Metropolitan of Moscow. And so, and he made it his big theme to talk about missionary work. That was his thing. He went around to monasteries and to lay people and said, you should do this. This is a worthy work. And he actually died. He lived a very happy life in Moscow because he was allowed to bring his son, I think his son was a priest as well, bring his family to Moscow, and he was surrounded by his grandchildren in his old age. And even though he was blind, he would serve the liturgy almost every day. He lost his eyesight, but he knew it all by heart. So he'd just serve, and he had deacons carry him where he needed to go, and he would preside at liturgies. And he died peacefully in the Lord in the, I think, 1850s as the Metropolitan of Moscow. He's buried here at Sergiev Posad. This is the great monastery of the Russian Church, the biggest, most impressive monastery, St. Sergiev Posad, outside of Moscow. He's buried in this church, and Matushka and I and the Bradshaws are able to venerate his relics. Next slide. Oh, sorry. I thought I had a reliquary in there, but his relics are there, and we were able to chant his troparion, and it was really wonderful. So, one story about St. Innocent before we continue with our saga here, that I have to read this to you, because this to me sums up so much of what God was doing through the missionary work of St. Herman and St. Innocent. In November 1829, St. Innocent reported to his bishop a remarkable encounter he had with an Onongan shaman. In 1828, I made a Birdarka journey, that's a boat, off to the island of Akun, for the purpose of ministering to the natives there. On coming close to the beach, all the people of the village dressed in their best clothes and were gathered on the shore, evidently for my reception. On getting out of the Birdarka, I asked the meaning of this. They answered that they knew I was coming and they came out to greet me and welcome me to their island. I asked why they were so dressed up, and they said, "We knew that you had left Unalaska for this island and that you would be here today, and to show you our joy, we have come here to welcome you. And who told you that I would be here today? How did you recognize me as Father Vinyaminov?" And they said, "Our shaman, old man Smirnikov, told us that you had started from Unalaska and would be here today, and that you would teach us about God and how to pray to him." Later, I met old man Smirnikov. He was about 60 years of age. He was believed to be a shaman. The reason for this was that this man performed unexplainable manifestations. One of the most striking was this. One woman, the wife of Theodor Zharov, stepped off a clipped trap, thereby verily severely injuring her knee. Anyway, he prophesied. I should have stopped there. But the point was, these kind of stories happened a lot of places in Alaska. The shamans, the pagans, would have this sense that something was about to happen, and they would prophesy, and all of a sudden, there the Orthodox would appear. And the question was, what do you do with that? And I think we say what St. Justin Martyr says, that the Spirit of God works even in those who are seeking God, but who don't consciously know of him yet. So, beautiful kind of stories from this period in the mission life of our church. He was St. Innocent was ultimately canonized in 1977 by the Russian Orthodox Church. The tradition in our church is the church in which you die is the one that canonizes you. So St. Innocent died on the territory of the Russian Church, so the Russian Church canonized him. St. Herman died on the territory of America, so the American Church canonized him. Just that's the way it works. So, our last character here, kind of in telling the missionary story of the Northern Mission, is St. Jacob, the Enlightener of the Aleuts, who was the first Creole, that is, mixed priest. He was half Aleut and half Russian. He spent 20 years quietly laboring among the Aleuts and Eskimo tribes, serving them, preaching, teaching. One of the most beautiful moments of his ministry, and we know this because we found in the 70s, I think it was, we found all his diaries. They were up in the attic somewhere. And they found them, and almost nothing was known about him. And it was through reading his diaries we realized what he had accomplished. But anyway, in one of the stories, there was about to be a civil war between these two groups getting ready to kill each other. And St. Jacob had the great idea of getting involved, preaching the gospel to them. And so before they killed each other, he had them all baptized and catechized, and they agreed to love each other. And that was the end of the war. And that was how he converted them and saved them from killing each other. So, little note as we transition here. St. Innocent, as the bishop of Alaska and later Metropolitan, he approved the sale of Alaska to the USA. Why? It was sold in 1867. Why? He argued that Orthodoxy in Alaska could serve as a leaven for the Orthodox faith in all of America. You detach it from Russia, move it to America, it opens the doorway to our faith entering the lower 48 and being a blessing to the people there. At the time of the sale of Alaska to the U.S., there were 12,000 practicing Native Orthodox. There were 9 fully functioning parishes with full-time priests. Alaska is very transient. 35 smaller chapel parishes, 17 schools, and 3 orphanages. And despite the active attacks on this mission by Protestants, Presbyterians especially, the governor was a Presbyterian, the new governor, and he saw to it that the none of the Alaskan schools could continue. They had to immediately begin learning English, and he allowed the Presbyterians preference in building things in Alaska, and they were allowed to run the school system. So, separation of church and state, right? Anyway, this was what happened, and pretty much the Orthodox were violently persecuted, violently in the sense that every legal means was used to oppose the Orthodox faith in Alaska. And yet, despite that, despite the fact that the lower 48, the church down here was able to offer little support, the church in Alaska has continued and is much larger than that number now. Though there have been lots of difficulties in every generation in Alaska because of the lack of money, the lack of lack of educated clergy, and they still struggle with that, which is why St. Herman Seminary was established about 30 years ago, and it's operating still. Bless you. So we turn now to the immigrant church. This first phase was a missionary phase. The second phase of our church life could be said to be an immigrant phase, which centers around the coming to America of different peoples of more or less Orthodox backgrounds. In 1870, the Bishop of Alaska, who was Russian, moved his see from Sitka to San Francisco. Why? Because he saw it as a missionary base. It was a place from which to do the work of the church in the lower 48 and to reach out to people who were beginning to immigrate from the old country into the United States of America. One of them was Bishop Vladimir Sokolovsky. He was bishop from 1888 to 1891. He brought singers and seminarians from his old Kolm diocese to translate liturgical music into English. He was one of the first people to begin the massive translation of church stuff, church music, church, and set it in English using Western notation. That began in the 1890s. He appointed Father Sebastian Dabovich. Next slide. He's a Serbian-American, born actually in America, of Serbian parentage. He appointed Father Sebastian to be the English preacher at the Russian Cathedral in San Francisco. And Bishop Vladimir would himself serve mostly in English, and he had a real strong sense of the mission work that would be taking place in America. Under the next bishop, who's not pictured on the picture of him, Bishop Nicholas, 1891 to 1898, the mission in the lower 48 entered its fastest period of growth. And one of the catalysts for this growth was in 1891, a group of Byzantine Catholics in Minneapolis. Do you know what Byzantine Catholics are? Uniates. Uniates, Greek Catholic, Byzantine Catholics. Back in the 1500s, in a part of Western Russia that could be called Ukraine, it could be called a lot of different things. Galicia, Limkovina, Bukovina, anyway, these places between where Ukraine and Belarus and Poland and Hungary, where all these places collide, there's this place, right? And they're kind of Slavic, and a lot of them are Eastern Rite Christians. Well, most of them, almost all of them were at one time Orthodox. In the 1600s, though, Poland, Lithuania absorbed most of those areas. And then later on, Hungary, Austria-Hungary. And those territories came under Catholic domination, meaning that the rulers of them were Roman Catholics. Well, the Catholics realized, rightfully, that our rite was essentially ancient. The way we worship was completely apostolic. And so they said, well, you want to accept the Pope, but what we'll let you do is we'll let you keep your rite. You can do the Orthodox stuff, the Orthodox ritual, but you have to remember the Pope in the liturgy. And so they were co-opted into the Roman Church with the Eastern Rite. And they became part of what was called the Unia. And in Russian, it's a very pejorative term. Sort of like, you know, I won't say. It was going to use a Star Trek analogy, but I won't. I'll spare you.
Orthodox Creed, I heard.
They say an Orthodox Creed. Yes, they do. They do. Anyway, the Unia, or the Byzantine Catholic Church, or the Greek Catholic Church, became the main worshiping body in this part of Europe. And to this day, a good chunk of Eastern Rite Christians in those areas remain in union with Rome as part of the Uniat Communion. Anyway, a huge number of those people came into America in the 1890s. And in 1891, a group of them were led by Father Alexis Toth in Minneapolis to renounce Rome. And this is St. Alexis. He later on was canonized. He was a married priest originally who was very popular back in the old country. He was a seminary professor, very charismatic. He always had a love for the Orthodox Church. He always felt that deep down he was Orthodox. And he sort of put up with Rome because he had to. Well, when he came to America, he went to visit a bishop, Roman bishop, named Bishop John Ireland. And Bishop John Ireland was an Irish-American. And if you know anything about the Roman Catholic Church in the 1800s, it was run by the Irish. Why? Why was it run by the Irish? They spoke English. There were lots of them, and they spoke English. And their whole thing was, let's assimilate. Let's become normal Americans. We want people to think we're just like everyone else, but we're Catholic. And so his whole thing, he was a very influential bishop. There was a whole group of bishops in the Roman Church that said, let's totally assimilate into America except for our religion, which means our dioceses have to look and feel the same. Everywhere you go, it has to be the same. It has to be very Protestant. Yeah? And we see the fruits of that now in the Roman Catholic Church in America. It's very Protestant. Yeah? And anyway, but this began because the Roman Catholic immigrants were so heavily persecuted by everyone else. In New England, in the early 1800s, the Irish were treated much like black people were in the South throughout the Jim Crow period. You know, Irish need not apply. No Irish allowed. Drinking fountains for no Irish permitted. I mean, very kind of, you know, and they look like Brits, right? You can't tell the difference most of the time. But there was this huge bias, and most of it was based on their religion. So anyway, Bishop Ireland was embarrassed to people like him because he was even weirder. Right, these guys are really weird. They're like more Catholic than the Catholics. So he said, I don't want priests like you. The other thing was he was married briefly, because in the Catholic Church allowed the union of priests to still be married. So he'd been married, which in the Latin bishop's view was just a terrible thing. So basically he refused to let him serve. And so St. Ignatius said, fine, I want to be Orthodox anyway. He finds a Russian Orthodox bishop. He goes to San Francisco. I don't know if he called him or not, but he got in touch with him. And he says, great, we'll receive you. And so he brings in all these people. By the time he dies, he's received 40, 50,000 unions from the Byzantine Rite into the Orthodox Church. And to this day, the core of our church, not in the South, but in Pennsylvania, Minneapolis, the big cathedral, it's all his people. It was these people that founded and established it, and then others have converted later. But the core is all these people. You know, it's like a big EOC. But folky, really folky. And they had a really rich folk culture that has... And all of our metropolitans, Metropolitan Theodosius, Metropolitan Herman, Metropolitan Irenae, all of the old OCA metropolitans, these were all these people. So, not Russian. They weren't real Russians. They were these, like, borderland Russians. Which this will play into things later on. Anyway, so I've talked without my notes now, so I need to get back to my notes. Tensions among the immigrant Orthodox. Surprise. Tensions among the immigrant Orthodox. In 1898, next slide, Bishop Tikhon comes to America. This is the one who will become patriarch later on. He comes as a missionary bishop to America and serves for 9 years until 1907. We'll show the later photo of him. Oh, no. No. We'll get to him later. But his priority, though, was to keep the church together, on one hand, and to missionize Americans. You know, so to keep all these groups that were kind of converting in, you know, on one hand, together, and the Russians and the Greeks and the Carpatha Russians, to keep them together and to keep the church open to people outside as well, which is why he commissioned the Red Book, the Hapgood Book. How many of you have seen the Hapgood Service Book? It's a beautiful red service book still published by the Antioch Archdiocese. Guess who ordered it published? Bishop Tikhon. He commissioned a very erudite Englishwoman to write this book that is still used. I used to use it all the time for different things.
Who?
The YMCA. The YMCA underwrote that service book. That's right. Thank you, Bert. But all these connections here, it's really interesting. But he was active, and he would visit the Episcopalians. He was very close to them. In fact, he was spearheading the dialogue with them to help bring them back in the Orthodox Church. He wanted to unite. He wanted to bring them back in. He actually recommended to the Synod of Bishops in Petersburg that we tweak their prayer book and allow them to be considered Orthodox, reordain their clergy so they have apostolic orders, but bring them into the church and let them have a Western rite, a Western unia for the Episcopalians. It didn't work out. Things went off the cliff in that church. And you'll see they went off the cliff in our church too, but in totally different ways. Anyway, one of the things he did that was very fascinating was he proposed a united synod in America with ethnic hierarchs, ethnic bishops who could minister to the particular flocks of ethnic people. So in other words, he imagined a synod that was headed by Russian, because this was a Russian diocese, right? But headed by a Russian metropolitan, who would work with the church in Russia, with a Greek bishop for the Greeks who would travel around, maybe several Greek bishops, an Arab bishop for the Arabs, Antiochians, Serbian bishop, Father Sebastian Dabovic, the one I showed you a picture. He was being groomed to become a bishop under Bishop Tigon. An Albanian jurisdiction. All these things were in the works. And of course, later on, I didn't put a photo of him in there. Later on, Bishop Tigon has ordained Bishop Raphael, who is an Arab. And they begin to do this. And Bishop Raphael works with St. Tikhon to bring all the Arabs into this church. And it works for a while. Until things begin to kind of fall apart. And I think at this point it's good to jump ahead to the next slide, which we've already previewed. What happens that makes things fall apart? Yes, Matushka.
Yes.
The Russian Revolution. And the Russian Revolution is a red letter event, definitely in the history of the world. Very red, very bold. The Russian Tsars, the Romanov family, had ruled Russia for 300 years. And the dynasty was not known for being very perceptive to the public will, shall we say. And in 1917, February of that year, the royal family is overthrown. This is called the February Revolution. And a bourgeois, sort of moderate, democratic republican government is installed in Petersburg. Not a communist government. By the way, 90% of Russians totally supported that revolution. You know, a lot of people, looking back on it, obviously Tsar Nikolai has been canonized and his family, and they were really holy people. I'll go on record as saying they were really bad rulers. In the sense that they did not have a handle on what was going on. They were not sensitive to any of the needs of what was happening in Russia, and their country was going to hell in a handbasket, so to say. It was bad. And the revolution was viewed by many as an important step. But then things got crazier and crazier. The Bolsheviks the Germans actually paid for Lenin to be sent from Switzerland through Germany in a sealed train. They wanted him to go to Russia so that he would throw Russia into chaos so that Germany could win the war. That's how they viewed Lenin. They knew that Lenin was going to cause a lot of problems. So they sent Lenin to Russia. Lenin caused a lot of problems. And in October 1917, he led the Bolshevik uprising, which became known as the Russian, the Bolshevik Revolution. At the same time, the next slide please, Bert. At the same time, St. Tikhon was elected Patriarch of all Russia. For 200 years, there had been no patriarch. Why? Because the all-pious Peter the Great, Emperor of Russia, in 17-something, had abolished the patriarchate and had declared that he was head of the church, like Henry VIII, which was totally a sin and wrong. And the church was sort of forced to go along with it, grudgingly. And all along, the church had been hoping for a break in the situation, which is why, by the way, they didn't shed a lot of tears when the Tsar fell. Because the first thing they did was they called a council in Moscow, the great all-Russian council of 1917, that elected him. That was the first thing they did, elect him. 5 years into it, they elect St. Tikhon, patriarch, and they begin an incredible council that actually sets the stage for a lot of what has happened in our Orthodox Church in America years later. Anyway, including focusing on issues like conciliarity, you know, the church not just being run top down, but really this idea of coming together of the people around with the hierarchs. The hierarchs, you know, we're a hierarchical church, but really fleshing out what that means to be conciliar as well. Very important themes for our church. And they talked about that there. But by within a couple years of the Bolsheviks coming to power, actually the Sabor, the council was dispersed early in 1918. They had no money, and the Bolsheviks were harassing them, so they had to disperse. They didn't finish their business. And within several years, all church properties had been confiscated. Even the places where churches were operating, technically the church didn't own them. They were leasing them from the Soviet state as a courtesy of the Soviet state. They didn't own them. 12,000 clergy were overtly murdered. 100,000 Orthodox leaders have been killed. By 1939, 54,000 parishes had become 100 parishes. Before the revolution, there were 54,000 churches in Russia. 100 of them were operating on the eve of World War II. Actually, World War II saved the church because Stalin agreed to open the churches. He was desperate. And the churches exploded again. And that actually kind of helped the church get to the very dark period, ironically. All 1,500 Orthodox monasteries were disbanded and destroyed. All 61 seminaries were closed. And the first victim of this was an American missionary. The next slide, please. St. John Kucherov. His feast day is October 31st because during the October Revolution, he was serving as a priest in outside of St. Petersburg. And he was leading a cross procession, asking the Lord to have mercy on the country and save it from violence. And the Bolsheviks had just taken over the day before. They drove out, told him to stop praying. He said, "I will not." And they shot him in front of his parishioners. They dragged his body around. But he had spent almost 15 years in America. And he himself had chrismated from the uni of 700 people in his ministry. And a very fruitful ministry over those years in America. He built the beautiful Holy Trinity Cathedral in Chicago. I should have put a slide in there of that. I'm sorry. But it's a fantastic man and a fine martyr. And to this day, his family are Orthodox Christians. And I think I've shared before, I met them when I went to the church near where he was serving in outside of Petersburg. And I said, "Where can I find out about St. John Kucherov?" Because he's American. I said, "Oh, there's his grandkids over there. I'm going to talk to him." And that's how I got to know them. And they've kept the memory of him alive in their family for all these years. So with the 1917 revolution, one thing we have to realize is that the church, the Russian missionary diocese in America, was essentially funded by the Tsar's personal piety. The Tsar loved missionary work. He funded the Russian Bible Society. He funded the Russian Missionary Society. 90% of the money came from the Tsar's personal household. When the Tsar fell, the money dried up. And what was paid for? The salaries were paid for of the clergy. The building funds were kind of kept jacked up by the Tsar's donations. If you go to the old churches of the OCA in the Northeast, you look at the bells, you'll almost always see an N with a 2, Nicholas II, on the bells, because these were donated by him as gifts to the Orthodox in America. And you find them all over the place. So anyway, when he fell from power, the money situation became critical. At the same time, other challenges developed. In Russia, a schismatic church called the Living Church became very prominent. The Living Church, they chucked the iconostas, they chucked celibate bishops. They wanted to have married bishops. They did all the prayers out loud. I gotta watch what I say. Anyway, it was pretty radical. There were a number of other changes too. They changed the fasting, you know, all these sort of things. They wanted to be relevant. That was their thing. They wanted to be a relevant church. St. Tikhon, the patriarch of Russia, anathematized them, accused them of being not only heretics but schismatics. But their revolutionary fervor appealed to a certain kind of worker population in America, and a number of our parishes in America of the Russian mission began to affiliate with the Living Church. And get this, this is even funnier. For a little while, the ecumenical patriarch was commemorating the Living Church as the Church of Russia. It's amazing. Very, very brief period, then they realized that was a big mistake. And a number of important Russian clergymen, including the future patriarch, Sergius, for a brief while entertained relations with the Living Church. I mean, they were legitimately ordained people who just simply started a schism. So they were anathematized, but they caused a lot of confusion in America as well. Our big cathedral, in St. Nicholas Cathedral, there was a big lawsuit in which the Living Church was fighting out with the local Metropolia over who got to control that church. So you have the Living Church, you have nationalism. So, you know, St. Tikhon had this vision of everyone being in one church together and having sort of ethnic bishops that would take care of the different aspects of church life. Well, with National, World War I was all about self-determination. We all can have our own country. We all have a right to our own space, right? So you saw Austria-Hungary break up into a dozen or so countries, six or seven countries. You saw parts break off of Russia. You saw Finland establish itself. All the Balkans, you know, all those countries. Greece takes over more land from the dying Ottoman Empire, and all those nations are carved out of the Ottoman remnants. And so it's a glorious time for people to have their say. And people in the churches are thinking, ah, yay, we can have our own Albanian church now. We can have our own Greek church. We can have all these jurisdictions, all these separate little fiefdoms, so to speak. And the Russians are just as guilty of that, by the way. The Ukrainians are also similar. The Ukrainians decided that they did not want to be under Russians anymore. So they pulled out and they started their own Ukrainian church. The problem was they didn't have any bishops. So they got a bunch of priests together and they prayed the bishop's prayer over each other, and they became self-consecrating bishops, which is totally uncanonical and problematic. And when that church was eventually reconciled to the broader church, the Ecumenical Patriarch years later would receive them into the canonical church. They actually reordained all the priests in the whole diocese because they were afraid that, well, this wasn't, they had to normalize the situation. And so they did.
Was this because the Russian church fell with the revolution? Is that why they scattered?
What were the advantages of the Russian church? I mean, the advantage of the Russian church was that it had organization. It had money. It had resources. With the resources gone and old enmities and old wounds reopened, why stick around? And that's what happened. They said, you know what? You don't offer us anything now? Bye-bye. And they left. And that's exactly what happened. Carpathia Rusyns did the same thing. They pulled out. They started their own church, Carpathia Russian Diocese. They also had new parishes leave Rome because Rome clamped down even more on them. So it was a combination. Strangest of all, the Romanian church, the Romanian parishes, they left the Russian Orthodox mission and found refuge, yes, where? With the Protestant Episcopal Church. And for a short period of time, were under the care of the Episcopal Church in America until the mid-20s, when they were finally reconciled back to the Patriarchate of Romania. Very strange situations. That tells you kind of how nuts things were in those days. So anyway, things kind of fell apart in the 1920s after the revolution. And not only did we see problems among different types of Orthodox, you saw, you know, Greeks and Russians and Arabs, but even within the Russian camp, there was a huge schism, in addition to the Living Church schism. And that's the schism that's known, it's not really a schism, maybe it's tensions that centered around the existence of a diocese in America, a diocese in Europe, and then another synod called the Karlovci Synod, which was formed in Serbia. In 1917, especially as we get into the 20s, the White Army start losing the war, the civil war against the Reds, right? And bit by bit, they find themselves isolated into these pockets in the Black Sea. And they end up evacuating from the Black Sea through Constantinople into the one place that would have them. Why did Russia get involved in the war? World War I? What happened? Anyone remember? Assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, yeah. And who assassinated him? He was an Austrian Grand Duke, right? Who assassinated him? A Serb did. And who defended them immediately when the Austrians invaded Serbia? Who said, we're not going to stand for this? The Russians. The Russians had this, and the Serbs knew they owed this debt to Russia for defending them. And so the Serbs agreed to let all these Russians settle in Serbia. And so, probably a million or 2 million Russians found themselves living in Serbia, in Belgrade. They just swamped all of Serbia. And I have a good friend from Pennsylvania. He actually was born in Constantinople on a ship passing through. And then he spent his childhood in Belgrade, outside of Belgrade, and grew up as part of this Russian life in Serbia. He was telling me one day about youth camp. He was a kid in youth camp, you know, and they had the Russian cadets, you know, they all wore their uniforms, and he said, you know, there was this great priest, I forget his name, he would take, whenever we were misbehaving, he'd take our toys and he'd put them in his wrestler sleeves and he'd carry them around and then give them back to us when we behaved better. He said, I forget his name. His name was, what was it? Father Florovsky? Oh, yeah, Father Georgi Florovsky, who became later on the Dean of St. Vladimir Seminary, brought Father Alexander Schmemann over, this whole history that's very rich for the OCA. Anyway, but this was life. They had these wonderful, amazing intellectuals and leaders and spiritual people living together in this ghetto, you know, in Serbia. And what ends up happening is most of the Russian bishops who have fled their sees because of the Bolsheviks, they gather there. The Patriarch of Serbia blesses them to set up a Holy Synod there, a synod in exile, which becomes known as the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia, Rokor, right? But what's interesting is before Saint Tikhon loses connection with the rest of the church, because he's under house arrest in Russia, what happens is he sends out messages to his exarchs in America and to Europe saying, you're my guides, you're there. And so these bishops are rightfully enthroned bishops in these territories, and they view themselves as, well, I'm the metropolitan of this area. I'm the bishop of this area, right? Because the patriarch said they were. Well, the bishops in exile have fled their sees. Right? They left their sees, and according to the canons, if you leave your see, you can't claim to be a ruling bishop anymore. So you can't comprise a synod. Right? You can't have a synod of retired bishops. That's not canonical. Anyway, so there was this huge question. So you left your, what are you guys then? You're a bunch of retired bishops, okay? That's nice. But that was the tension between the bishops in America of the Russian missionary diocese that was left, that became known as the Metropolia, and the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. What was the relation to these two bodies? And it worked pretty well as long as Rokor was letting the bishops in America do what they wanted to do. The moment they started to suggest things and try to administer America, that's when the problems began. Because the bishops in America said, no, you're not over us. You're nice guys we like in Serbia. I'm glad we know you. But that was the issue. And things come to a head even more because in World War II, so you have all these Russians in Serbia. World War II, the Germans invade Serbia, right? And they're getting ready to invade Russia right afterwards. Well, the Germans tell the Russians, and the Serbs are livid, the Serbs are going to fight the Germans to the death. The Germans tell the Russians, if you join us, we'll unleash you on the Bolsheviks. And you may form white armies to liberate your homeland. And so, in massive numbers, the Russians in Serbia enlist to fight against the tyranny of Stalin. Not a bad idea. The problem is you're working with the tyranny of Hitler. Not good options, right? And the Serbs are livid at the Russians. And so when the war is over, the Russians in Serbia find themselves kicked out. And they end up becoming displaced persons, DP camps. And the Holy Synod of Rokor is meeting in a DP camp outside of Munich. And that's kind of where they find themselves. And eventually, they are able to get out and go to America, where they set up Rokor parishes in America. And that's how Rokor comes to America. That's the sort of history. But the vision is very different. So you had the earlier Russian mission comprised of Alaskans, right? And then later on you have the immigrants who come. And these two people, they're natives, in Alaska's case, or they're people that have said, we're leaving our country to stay here. We are Americans. And you have the people who come out of Serbia from Russia and then through Munich into America, and they're good people, but they have a very different worldview. Their view is, we want to go back to Russia. We want to preserve holy Russia. And most of them are monarchists, too. They were very kind of conservative white Russians, the most conservative of them all. And so they want to preserve old Russia. And they come to America, and this is why, for years, the Russian church abroad, outside of Rokor and the Metropolia, it was like this. Because they had two totally different church cultures, even though they're both Orthodox, whole different ways of approaching problems, whole different... What's the goal of our church? Is the goal of our church, the Metropolia would say, is to keep the Orthodox faith in this land and to have our kids be Orthodox. Well, what's the goal for Rokor? It's to be really Orthodox and go back. You know, very different. And be as Russian as possible so that our kids don't lose a bit of it. And they had this idea as well. If you read the literature from the 60s and the 70s, they were to go back and be the seed that helped revitalize Orthodoxy. And the shock for Metropolitan Loris You know, he was the metropolitan that led the reunion efforts between Rokor and Moscow in 2007, 2003 years ago. Late metropolitan Lars, a blessed memory. He was just shot when he went to Russia. He went as a plain parish priest. He didn't go as a bishop. He went incognito, just as a priest. And the clergy he was with called him Father, not Your Eminence. And he was shocked at how much they preserved. He said, these people have preserved the full faith. We thought we'd have to go back and missionize them. And he said, no, we don't. They're fully Orthodox. And it was a shock to the Rokor people. Because they expected, you know, the Soviets were all bad and everything. Anyway, I'm jumping ahead of things now. I got excited. I'm sorry. I find this part of the history very interesting. Because, you know, there's a lot of misunderstandings between Rokor and Metropolia. And between the Moscow Patriarchate and Rokor. And a lot of it just had to do with what were their experiences? What was their goal? And given what they'd all experienced, each group had very logical expectations of what things would be like. So, well, let's back up a little bit. Recapping in very brief detail, we're wrapping things up here, the story of the Metropolia. So in the 1920s, the Metropolia finds herself stripped of all the other jurisdiction, all the other ethnic groups. The Arabs leave and form the Antiochian Church. What Greek parishes were ever in the Metropolia in the Russian mission left to join the two Greek jurisdictions, which we'll hear about with Father George in 2 weeks. That's a whole other story. And so things kind of break apart. And the Metropolia comes forth. Metropolitan Platon is sent by Patriarch Tikhon to be the ruling hierarch in America. That's the last act of the patriarch. And he sort of lets us do our thing. But not with any formal canonical mandate. What are we? Are we an autocephalous church? Are we an autonomous church? Because autonomous churches, technically, you have to have your primates confirmed by the mother church. The Metropolia never did that afterwards because we viewed those links as somewhat tainted by the communists. So we just did our own thing for a long time. We were in kind of canonical la-la land. All the churches commune with us, but what were we? It wasn't clear. Anyway, so this continued for a long time. It was a very ethnic church, very Russian church, very Carpatho-Russian church, probably better to say, very Carpatho-Russian. Coal mining peoples. Our people were very at the bottom rung of society throughout most of these places. That's interesting how I say our people, because I was around them. I felt like I was one, even though I'm not one of them, I felt like I was one of them in places like Pennsylvania, because that's the culture. If you go to Scranton, where a lot of our people settled, it's shocking. You go and you see Clark Summit, which is this beautiful. You drive into town. It's foggy and gorgeous, and red doors on the Anglican churches. It's wasp as can be. It's beautiful. And then you know they're all Episcopalians and Lutherans, and maybe some Presbyterians. You go down into the beautiful downtown area. And it's where the big Catholic cathedral is, Irish Catholic. You know, it was what Bishop Monaghan or something like that, you know. Roman Catholic, Irish Catholic. You go further out, it's the Italian part of town, right? And then you go further out and you see some of the other Southern Europeans. You see some Greeks. Then you go further out and you see the Slovenians and the Lithuanians. And you go furthest out, and it's the Carpatho-Russians at the very end, with the Poles. And the little church that was right near my house, it was a Russian Orthodox church that had gone back and forth between the Rokor and Metropolia. Whenever they get tired of each other, they go back, and whenever they get tired of the bishop, they'd switch jurisdictions. And it was really funny. And it was a Rokor parish, it was a hardcore Muscovite, right? Well, they had these really cushy pews in the church. And I asked them, I said, why do you have these pews in here? They said, well, because the Polish Catholic Church across the street, you know, they're Catholics and they're Poles, that's bad. They got really nice pews, so we're going to have better pews than them. And that's how these things, that's how things worked. And the Russians were, I remember one time, I was talking to someone, I was voting up there, and they asked me, well, your name's Patterson, you're not from around here. And I said, yeah, you're right. And I said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm a seminarian at St. Tikhon's. I said, that's the Russian seminary. Why would you want to go there? Just totally scandalized because it was a class thing. It was all, everything was seen through class and ethnicity up there. And the way it worked is you had the WASP that settled it first. The Irish were the foremen. The Irish ran things for the WASPs. And then the Italians were not so bad. And then further down the list you go, you have the newer immigrants come. They do the worst jobs, and the Russians were at the very bottom. By Russians, I mean really Carpathian Russians. Not great Russians. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But so, some stories. I'm going to tell about three stories here because I think it shows the complexity of the situation in America in these times. You know, we talk about the Russian mission, but in reality, it wasn't so clear that the Russian mission was always the church in America. And I hope Father George talks about this when he's here, because in our, there's a really wonderful book by Father Kishkovsky and Mark Stokoy called Orthodox Christians in North America. And Bert told me this is actually online. It is a great resource, but it represents a kind of classic Metropolia story, OCA story, of Orthodoxy in America, which focuses on the Russian mission, which was incredible. One thing we have to realize, though, is that in 1892, there were only two parishes in the lower 48. One was Russian, and one was Greek. And the Greek church wasn't under anybody. It wasn't under Greece. It wasn't it was an independent Orthodox church. Can you imagine that? It's impossible, canonically. But I'm going to read, this is incredible. The church in New Orleans, that was the one Greek church, was founded in 1865 by a group of Orthodox people led by a Greek cotton merchant named Nicholas Benacci. This parish was a multi-ethnic community, and besides Greeks, it included Antiochian Arabs and Slavs. The U.S. Census of 1790 described it as part of the Church of Greece, but not really. The first priest to visit New Orleans wasn't the parish priest, but he visited and served the liturgy a couple times there, was a strange character named Father Agapius Honcharenko. This man was an itinerant Ukrainian of questionable credentials who was visiting New York in 1865 when he was contacted by the New Orleans parish. He was not connected to the Russian church. He had no canonical papers. He actually claimed that the Tsarist government had put a price on his head for his involvement in revolutionary activities. Honcharenko had some sort of connection with the Church of Greece, but it was not clear exactly what it was. Anyway, the New Orleans parish itself was a really fascinating community. Before they had actually organized themselves as a parish, they raised their own Orthodox militia to fight on the Confederate side of the Civil War. Later on, from 1881 to 1901, the community had a priest from Bulgaria, a Slav. Until 1906, most of the church records were kept not in Greek, not in Bulgarian, but in English. Remarkable. It was only later that Greek became the dominant language. So, but this is the kind of story of Orthodoxy in America. It's not that crazy, but that's really crazy. But it wasn't as neat as maybe this book portrays. You know, in this book's approach, everything is cut and dry. Russian has jurisdiction over this area. It's a missionary diocese. Everyone's on board with the missionary. That wasn't really true. I mean, it's true in one sense, and in another sense, it's not quite complete. So, because churches like Holy Trinity in New Orleans are actually fairly common. Not as you go on later, but in the early days. And so there were a number of parishes in 1917 that were not affiliated with the Russian metropolis, even though technically the Russian church had jurisdiction here, technically. There were already Greek churches being formed in union with Greece and in union with Constantinople. Because you've got to remember, another complicated history. You have the church in Constantinople, right, which was the Ottoman church. It was under the Ottoman yoke. Greece begins to be free in 1825. The Greeks have ecclesiastical freedom. The Ottomans don't want the patriarch involved in that at all. So they have to bless a new church being formed, the Church of Greece. So you have Greeks both in Asia Minor, who are Greek Orthodox, but under Constantinople. You have other Greeks in Greece under Athens. And they're both really Greek, but they're totally different churches. In communion with each other. They could serve together. So you have a complete... But Father George will talk about... This is a whole huge mess that's really interesting.
The other Russian church... There's a Greek church, you said, and then a Russian church in the late 1800s. Is that in San Francisco?
That was San Francisco... Right, San Francisco for Cathedral.
Yeah. Is that the one where St. John of Shanghai is?
No. Because St. John of Shanghai is Rokor.
Oh.
We can take that up in a second. So that's one parish. Another parish here that's really interesting is the community in Chicago. In the 1880s, even before the big immigration started, Chicago had a growing Orthodox population. By 1888, there was about 1,000 Orthodox Christians in the city. Most of them were Greeks or Serbs. And despite the fact that they weren't Russian, they petitioned the nearest bishop, who was a Russian, to send them a priest. In 1888, the Russian bishop responded with a petition by asking to hold the meeting to figure out if there was enough interest to support a church. The main speakers of this meeting were a Greek, a Montenegrin, and a Serb. The Greek man was named George Brown, who had come to America as a young man and had fought in the Civil War. George Brown gave a short speech, and it's short enough that I'll read most of it now to you. This is a historian named Matthew Namey. He's a very good blog at orthodoxhistory.org. It's fascinating. But anyway, the text of George Brown's address is this. "Gentlemen," he said, "union is the strength. Let everybody make his mind and have no jealousy. I have no jealousy. I am married to a Catholic woman, but I hold my own. Let us stick together like brothers. If our language is two, our religion then is one. This is good. The priest, he make the performance in both language. We have our flags built. It's the Greek flag and the others. No big deal." You know, but this was the church life. And if they were under the Russians for a while, later on they bolted one of the Greeks. It was crazy. It was chaotic. It was a mess. And yet, the life of the church went on. And that's part of the beauty of all this. One final story here is the story of St. Tikhon's Monastery, which I think connects us back in. I want to avoid making this too neat, because the story is not neat. You can't wrap this up in a package. But I think what I want to do, at least with my talk, is to say, you know, we began with the missionary vision. We have all these other factors. You have nationalism. You have immigration policy, which I didn't really talk about too much, but it affected when people came in and when they didn't. Immigration policy, nationalism, some politics. But really, at the end of the day, what we have to come back to all the time, I believe, if we're going to be a healthy church, is this vision of reaching out to our people. You know, missionary work in America. And it began with monasticism. And I believe, and this is Metropolitan Jonah's vision, I think, that it must end, or rather re-begin, with monasticism as well. And that was St. Tikhon's vision in May 1905, when he blessed the proposal to form a monastery. There were all these little coal miners in the Scranton area, these really simple people, and they collected $700, which is a huge, that's more than a year's worth of money for a family. They gathered all this money together to buy a farm to establish an Orthodox monastery. And that monastery was named, out of love for their bishop, St. Tikhon, after the patron saint of Bishop Tikhon, St. Tikhon of Zadonsk. And they bought this farm in South Canaan, Pennsylvania. Next slide, please. Oh, that's the Karlovsky Synod. Sorry, Rokor Synod. Back, please. This is St. Tikhon's Monastery. You can go back and forth. This is the main church. This building was actually constructed. This is the first building that was made. It's just a church. In the old days, it was a refectory, a brotherhood building, and a chapel when they started. So this building is, and it was just wood on the outside. They've bricked it up since then, put domes and wings on it. This right here is Father Alexis Toth's tomb, now St. Alexis. It's empty now because he was exhumed and his relics were incorrupt. And now his relics are inside the church, but you can still go in the tomb and pray there if you want to. So, but anyway, St. Tikhon's, this is beautiful. This is sort of my, this excites me. The first pilgrimage was Memorial Day, 1905. Again, that's so American, is it not? You've got, you know, you can't do a feast day because we have an American calendar, so you do Memorial Day, right? You have a 3-day weekend, so you can have a good time. So they begin a 3.5-hour cross procession from Mayfield. Mayfield, by the way, is Bishop George's of Mayfield. That's his cathedral, because they jumped ship from Metropolia to Rokor back in the 80s. That's a whole other, yeah. We're not even going there. But anyway, Mayfield was one of our oldest Metropolia parishes at the time. They gathered there at 5:30 in the morning with banners and choir and clergy, and they marched 3.5 hours over the mountain. And if you've ever been there, it's a huge mountain. It's For a flatland, that means a big mountain. They march with all their families up the mountain and down, and then serve liturgy afterwards. These people were brave. But this is the kind of excitement they had. Hundreds and hundreds of people there that first day. Divine liturgy with Father Arseny, who later became a bishop and is probably considered a saint by many. The enlightener of Winnipeg, first bishop of Winnipeg. And then the next year, they had all the hierarchs of North America, St. Tikhon, St. Raphael of Brooklyn, and Bishop Innocent. Because they had so many thousands of people coming, they got the railroad to build a spur that put it about a mile from the monastery. They had a special train station built just for the pilgrimage. 20 coaches were reserved. It was just amazing. And so they went in 1912. They began with 12 monks. By 1912, they had 12 monks and 27 orphans in the orphanage. But after the revolution, they had some troubles because the bishop had mortgaged the property because of money issues. And St. Tikhon actually was put up for sale. And as I understand it, this wasn't in any of these books, but I heard the story once. It was the Episcopalians that arranged for our people to buy it back at the auction, and no one else bid on it out of kindness to us. So there were some good Christians who were looking out for our monasteries and our peoples. So that's how St. Tikhon survived the auction block in the 1920s, in the midst of all this. But this is why, though, the bishops had to mortgage everything because of the lack of funds from Russia. Well, there's a reason why there was radical anti-clericalism in the old Metropolia, because they didn't trust the bishops. They felt it was the bishops' fault that these things happened. And so this mentality really lingered on in our Metropolia for a long time. And the reason we don't have it in our diocese, everybody, is because our diocese is a missionary diocese. Our people don't, by and large, come from the old stock of the OCA. So we kind of escaped that terrible tendency, which I wouldn't have liked very much. So anyway, St. Tikhon's monastery, some great saints came out of it. One of the interesting stories is that in 1930-something, four monks left St. Tikhon's because they felt it wasn't spiritual enough. Guess where they went? They were heading up to Canada to start a monastery, and on the way, they got to upstate New York, and they saw a little town called Jordanville, and there they built Holy Trinity Monastery. And then they were the second monastery of the Metropolia. Until they decided Metropolia wasn't good enough, they had to join Rocor. And that's how Rocor then, after the war, they moved their headquarters from the camps over to Jordanville, which is already established as a monastery, and that becomes the center, really the kind of practical headquarters of Rocor. It came from St. Tikhon's. It's a schism of St. Tikhon's. So
Holy Trinity was originally in the Metropolitan.
Yes. 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 So anyway, I can say a lot more about St. Tikhon's, but it has been an important place in the life of our church. Almost all of our clergy has either come from here or from St. Vladimir's. And many of them have spent time at both. And I'm one of them that spent time at both. I'm very fortunate in that regard, I think. Anyway, I could say so much more. I know you have lots of questions, and question time is fun. I've left out a lot of things, but it's 9 o'clock. I don't want to delay anybody. Oh, yes. Thank you, Bert. We can end sort of our discussion tonight with summing up briefly what happened in 1970. So between 1920 and 1970, the Russian Metropolia was a basically ethnic church that served Carpathian Russian people, some Russians, maybe some other people too, but mostly those type of folks. In 1970, we decided to kiss and make up with the Moscow Patriarchate. But the deal was, we would basically be let alone to do what we were doing before, except we would acknowledge them as our mother church. And so they agreed to let us be independent, basically, autocephalous, self-heading, electing our own metropolitan, which we're already doing, but canonically autocephalous, under the aegis of the Moscow Communion. And so we... next photo, please, Bert. This is a photo of Metropolitan Pimen, who was the vicar for His Holiness Alexei the First,
And Bishop Theodosius, later on Metropolitan Theodosius of the OCA, exchanged a document called the Tomos of Autocephaly, in which the Russian Church gives the Russian Orthodox Greek Catholic Church autocephaly, hence taking the name Orthodox Church in America. That's the moment. And this is a very important moment in the life of our church. The problem...
Read the Tomos online.
Yeah, the Tomos is on the OCA website. And the gist of it is that the Russians and the people that are now the OCA see our whole history as an extension of the Russian mission. That's how we understand ourselves. That's how we define ourselves. That's the story, if you will. And that's an important story. But I think what you're going to see with Father George and Father Tom is that the Antiochians and the Greeks have a different story. And part of the thing is they don't buy this. They say, according to the Greek understanding at least, that autocephaly can only be granted by the Patriarch of Constantinople, not by a mother jurisdiction. So what they say is, they say, you guys are fine. You know, y'all are real bishops, real church, but this whole autocephaly business, we don't buy that. So they consider basically us to be autonomous, and that the Russians are pretending we're autocephalous. That's kind of what they say. That's neither here nor there, but it's going to affect how we all come together. You know, what we do with autocephaly, how we process that, is going to affect how we deal with the Greeks and the Antiochians, everyone else, as we talk about uniting more and more over the years. Because autocephaly is kind of offensive to... The OCA's autocephaly is offensive to some of the other jurisdictions. Because they view it as sort of, well, who are you to have autocephaly? We don't. You know? So...
It's interesting, though, that we've been acting as an autocephalous church for all these years, even from what you're saying, from the 1920s on.
Right.
Even though canonically, maybe not accurately.
This, I think that as they described it at the diocesan assembly, this is kind of an old dance between Constantinople, and, on the one hand, and then also Moscow on the other, and who actually has the right to do everything. Constantinople is actually first among equals. But where does the equals come into it? So it's fascinating for church government.
Well, and to echo what you're saying, the other issue is autocephalic tradition was granted and there was one church in that area. In our situation, there are multiple churches. You know, it's not just... Had this happened in 1910, we had most of us in one church and a smattering of Greek churches, it might have worked more easily. But right now, you know, right now the OCA population is, I think, a third of the Greek Orthodox Church. You know, and they've had a lot more immigration than us, and they have a lot bigger population. We're bigger than the Antiochians, but it's hard for us to say numerically, hey, you got to follow us. That's not very humble. It seems sort of odd, maybe. And I think that's one of the issues, because if we're autocephalous, then that also means to the Greek patriarch, to Patriarch Bartholomew in Istanbul, it means that if he acknowledges that, he has to say that his church is autocephalous too. And he's not ready to do that, partly because if he loses the American church, who does he have? He only has 5,000, there are only 5,000 Greek Christians left in Turkey. And he views his situation as very important in the world, rightfully so. And he's an important role to play in the world of the Orthodox Church. But without people to support him and to be part of this church, who does he have? And this is the issue.
The meeting coming up this spring is about this moment. But it's not about us. It's about what's going on between Moscow and the Ecumenical Patriarch at this moment. And what's fed out of that. So it's about this moment, but it's not about us. And that's important for us to understand as we begin to look at what's happening in these days, because this is a pretty cool moment to be alive in church history.
Very much so. Well, we jumped around a lot. I'm sorry. I should have been a little more organized, but part of it is the enthusiasm here. Are there any questions about the Russian mission? Go ahead.
Can you explain to me what's autocephalous? Is that what it is again?
I'd like to pick that up on the third, on the last.
Autocephaly?
And autonomy.
Okay.
We'll define those out of the...
Yeah, maybe we'll flush that out later on. So now you have a teaser. You have to come back. So Bert put on the screen. Thank you, Bert. Our next three fall lecture series are going to be the October 13th, Wednesday night, 7:30, Father George Wilson on the Greek experience in North America. Our third will be Father Thomas Galloway on November 3rd, discussing the Arab Antiochian Orthodox community in America. And then Bert and I will be working on bringing the stories together on December 8th, which is the Wednesday before St. Herman's Feast. It'll be a nice preparation for St. Herman's Day, which for the OCA is a big, that's our main feast day in our local church because he's our patron saint. That's how we understand it. One difference, I think, you know, the Greeks, he's on the calendar, but they don't really celebrate him, you know, because for us, he's part of our self-understanding. He's part of our awareness of who we are. And for the Greeks, and to a lesser degree, the Antiochians, he might not be as significant. So, anyway, questions?
How many OCA parishes are there in the U.S.?
I hope not mistaken. I think there are 500 or 600. Yeah. Yeah.
There are just over 70.
Right. And our diocese started in 1979 with six parishes. So we've grown from 6 to 70 in that time, in 30 years. So God's blessed us. May we grow a lot more. Basically, the way numbers break down, the Greeks are the largest. We're the second largest. The Antiochians are maybe two-thirds as large as we are. Rokor is maybe a third as large as we are. Rokor is relatively small. But they have a lot of monks. They have a lot of monasteries, interesting enough.
Yeah, I thought Rokor would be a lot bigger based on...
No,
the
Rokor is rather small. So...
Rokor change internally? I mean, I know Jordanville has traditionally been very Russian-oriented. Has that been transformed over time? Are they focusing more on this country?
I was told that Metropolitan Lawrence had shared that as long as he was alive, they'd always use Russian in the refectory even. They've never uttered English in the temple before, in the church. And Metropolitan Hilarion, who was elected after his eminence Lawrence died in 2008, I think it was. Metropolitan Hilarion's first thing was to do the announcements in English, which was sort of a revolution, you know. Metropolitan Hilarion is, I believe, a Canadian of Ukrainian origin. I think Rokor is in the process of... What they've realized, I think, is that, well, okay, communism fell, the Russian church has revived, well, and we're still here. We didn't go back, right? We didn't go back to live in Russia. What does that mean? And I think they're finally, I think that's sort of hitting them. And the people I've met in Rokor now, their self-understanding is much more like what I'm used to among pious OCA people, you know, ethnic OCA people in the north, you know, so... I suspect there's a convergence going on here between the two churches that I can detect. I can detect it. And one of the things I've talked about with Bert, I think, is that I want to do a paper sometime on bringing the stories of these two groups together in the persons of Father Seraphim Rose and Father Alexander Schmemann. You know, for a long time, these two were sort of like icons of the opposing camps. Father Schmemann was a sort of liberal, modernist, OCA guy that wanted to make orthodoxy relevant to American culture, you know, which is certainly a caricature of him. And then you had Father Seraphim Rose, who's sort of an American convert to orthodoxy, but who is very much Russian-minded and very kind of Russophile, you might say, and which is also a character that not taking him seriously either. And so these two were kind of like these symbols. And I would argue, I think the two of them are very close, actually, very close together and not at all opposed. One of the tasks of our time is to sort of take these threads and weave them together. I find it a lot easier personally to weave Rokor and OCA together than some of the other churches in the OCA together, because the traditions are a lot closer. Liturgically, they're a lot closer. That's just a personal thing for me. But the other thing with the OCA to note is that when the OCA was established, we brought in really quickly the Romanian church. It was a Romanian jurisdiction under... Archbishop Valerian Trifa was added to the OCA. Now Bishop Nathaniel is the head of it. And there's a Holy Domitian Monastery in Rife Junction as part of that Romanian community, which is so it's following St. Tikhon's vision of the sort of multi-ethnic synod with united together with one metropolitan. So we have a Romanian church under the OCA. We have in the OCA rather. And that's pretty vibrant, actually.
We have a Bulgarian church, which is less vibrant because there aren't that many. Most of the Bulgarian parishes have gone American, which means that you can't distinguish them from regular OCA parishes. So the point of it, it sort of begs the question, why? And that's one of the things they're trying to deal with right now, is what to do with these parishes, because they're not really Bulgarian any more than you'd have a Russian parish that's OCA, you know. But the reality is most of our parishes that are very ethnic are shrinking. And the ones that are growing are the ones that are constantly trying to reach out and to draw people in. So I've seen parishes that are growing rapidly. I've seen parishes that are declining. And part of the decline in places like Pennsylvania has a lot to do with demographics. Pennsylvania is the economy has been terrible for 40 years, Rust Belt. And so, you know, the kids, I remember talking to people in these parishes when I was at St. Tikhon's, and they would just, they'd almost be weeping because our kids, they leave. And they move away, and they don't marry Orthodox girls sometimes. And so they, you know, a lot of them, you know, there's been a drift somewhat from the church when they move, because these people had a very old country kind of view of place, and you know, church was about your farm and your home, you know, or the you had your church and you had the coal mine, or and you had your family and your, and if you break that up, they it's hard to process. But what is church like now? And this is why we're talking about the importance of community, because we don't have it in our culture. We have to construct it, which is kind of scary.
We don't have it here, but in an area where we've talked about doing ministry, in Eastern Kentucky, they very much do.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that I think that will could preach in this area of the country. An interesting thing to note, on any Sunday morning in the OCA, the liturgy is being done in 19 different languages.
That's a good point. 19 different languages.
And that's all the way from the Aleut and the Inuit language.
Still used to this day.
In Alaska, all the way down to Bulgarian and Romanian.
We've got 20,000 Mexicans in the OCA.
Yes, and yeah.
And I believe I thought they used some Nahuatl, which is one of the indigenous Aztec-related languages.
And really, the work in Mexico that has gone on with the Exarchate in Mexico is a direct vision of our former bishop, our previous bishop, Lenny Dimitri.
Our founder.
And just his love and his willingness to just kind of push out in every direction. It was his vision to say, you know, we need to grow from, six churches and a handful of missions in 30 years, the 30th year of his episcopacy. He was, we founded the 70th church. Vladika Jonah, I wondered, so how can you follow that up? Vladika Jonah walked in about 6 months after the announcement was made, and I sat in a room at the diocesan council, and he said, okay, every one of your deaneries has about the same number of churches that we had when we started the Diocese of the South. How do we get from there to 70 churches in the next 30 years?
Yeah.
That's the vision of our metropolitan, to go out there and do that. And I don't think it'll stop it.
Well, and I think this is why, with all the discussions going on with the other churches, the one thing I'm sensing from metropolitan is that we cannot afford to lose that vision for the sake of unity. And well, that's going to be one of the
issues.
This
is what we bring. I mean, this is one of the gifts that we bring to the table, is this missionary vision that's unique.
One thing I ran into, or some people I ran into on Spruce Island at the monastery, was one Japanese monk, called Timothy. I met a seminarian from St. Tikhon's who was from Mexico City, Abraham. And I also met a guy from San Diego who was publishing Death to the World out of this old publication.
Yeah.
And it's really exciting. Like, to me, like, that was a little glimpse of like some direction.
Multi-ethnic stuff, yeah. And that's very cool. Any other questions or thoughts tonight? I hope this was I hope this was helpful in putting pieces together.
It actually is reassuring to me. I had heard some of the history of how chaotic it was. And, I'm just looking forward to, with the ecumenical patriarch getting involved and saying, let's plan and see what this looks like. It's like,
absolutely.
Well, it's the same chaos it's been in some ways. And
at least now it's grouped chaos.
It's sorry to
it's clustered
together.
Chaos.
It's kind of the opposite, but it's driven out of all that,
Well, I should have put a picture of the bishops up here, but there was that one photograph of, for the first time in the history of America, every bishop since the Russian mission Not here. I didn't put it in there. There's,
oh, yeah.
For the first time in the history of the Orthodox Church here in this country, all the bishops were gathered together, except for like one or two. But it was everybody, basically, from all the jurisdictions were gathered in a room together, and they actually had liturgy together afterwards. Can you imagine? So there's some... That alone is pretty amazing. You know, it's maybe to someone outside the church, that seems really trivial, but for our church, that's a big deal. Things change very slowly. But I think they're going to change quickly, and we need to be ready for that.
I think the other thing that strikes me is the idea of, in some ways, we are free not to be burdened by ethnicity interests. You know, I think the Greek experience and Antiochian experience has been a little bit more driven by that.
Absolutely.
But the Diocese of the South, predominantly, has been Orthodox, and that's it. And so
right.
It's an opportunity and a challenge.
Well, I think one of the things to note is that one of the challenges of America is, and this is what they always ask, is which ethnicity are we talking about in America? Because, you know, Southerners are very different from Midwesterners. And in Nicholasville, I like to point out that 20%, I was shocked when I came here and realized that 20% of the people here are Latinos with their own separate culture. And then you've got the folks, probably 25 or 30 or 40% of our people here are from Eastern Kentucky, transplants. And you got folks, you have the Asbury culture, which is a transplanted culture. You have people like me, they're just random transplants. And that's the challenge of America. And that's why this is not easy. And why, you know, and this is why some converts go to Greek churches and love it. Because they have a culture. Wow, I can go here and the Greek dancing, and I can learn the Greek language. And there are a lot of converts that love that. And I would not deny that. I mean, there's... You know, I feel that's somewhat with some of the Russians, just because I know the Russian culture. I don't want to be in a Russian parish, but I get that as someone who loves culture. And there's something very satisfying about that for some people, not for everybody. And one of the things that Father John Baer once said, he's the dean of St. Vladimir's, he said he actually wondered if God wasn't God's blessing for America to have many jurisdictions. He said, I know it's uncanonical, but we're able to minister to different types of people with our different churches in a way that conveys still a certain Catholicity and unity of purpose. You know, I wouldn't want to go too far, but I think he's making a valid point that there are people that have converted to Orthodoxy here that could never convert at Panagia, and there are people that have converted and drawn closer to Christ there that could not do so here.
Well,
you know,
we've had some of our folks early on that had to go quicker, and they went to St. Andrews. And that was okay. I mean, you know, that's what they needed.
That being said, I love what we do here.
Yeah.
You know, and I think...
Well, and Carl, who, you know, went to St. Andrews because it was the closest thing to what he had grown up. You know, his mother looked at him and said, there's an OCA parish in town. I expect you to be there.
And we talked with Slavic accents around here to make her feel more at home.
Yeah, that's it.
Little Mary Lizak, good sweetheart. Any other questions? We can talk all night. This is good stuff.
Well, I was thinking with people that are still in ethnicities, if the OCA did, you know, take care of all the other ethnic churches, do you think it'd still be a problem for them to reach out to people that are on ethnicities still? Or?
That's the question. That's the big fear with some of the ethnic parishes. You know, because what do they have? They have ethnic people. So if you don't, if you're not able to do that, then how's your parish going to survive? That's the question.
Say, but you know, I was listening to a podcast with the head of Hellenic College, and he said, you know, we're fifth and sixth generations in, and what that meant in the first and second generations, and what it means now is completely
very different. Very different.
And how we're ministering to people, and what the ministry that we're preparing them to go out to do. It's extremely different today. So they're even talking about that.
I think that question is more relevant if you're talking about a church that's having fresh immigration. So, for instance, there are some Russian OCA parishes that are actually... One of my good friends is a rector in California. He's got a Russian parish. Russian, like new Russians, like off the boat. And, like, if he doesn't do stuff in the Russian... He's going to miss to unite them to the church. And one of the reasons why I think the Moscow Patriarchate was drawn to Rokor
And why they're not chucking their own parishes, because they want to make sure that there are parishes in America that can still reach out to new immigration. Because OCA parishes, by and large, can't do that. Honestly, we're not capable. Most of our priests are also Russian. So there's a real need, at least in places, to have parishes that are capable of gathering the scattered flock. But Bert's absolutely right. I mean, once you get the second, third, fourth generation, that stuff can become a liability. So, and more than liability, if the gospel's reduced to that, it becomes wrong.
Yeah.
You know. So, but I think there's nothing wrong with ethnic stuff, provided that everything's held in the right order, you know, held correctly, whatever that means. I don't know. Let's sing. I won't rush out.
It is truly meet to bless thee, O Theotokos, ever blessed and most pure, and the Mother of our God, more honorable than the cherubim, and more glorious beyond compare than the seraphim. Without corruption thou gavest birth to God the Word. True Theotokos, we magnify thee.
Thank you all. Tired yet?
Yes, it's been a wonderful and full week today.
That'd be great. Yeah. Thank you. And then, Frederica.
Stop that.
Ah.